What's new in Windows Server 2012 R2? We can actually see this has been a significant upgrade to the studios.
We can
see what is going on.
We can. And apparently, so can everybody else.
I know. So if you're out there, you can hear us. Hello. Nice to see you. Thank you very much for sticking around through a couple of different issues that we managed to work through. Apparently, someone crossed the streams and things were strange. So we're back. We're here. We're going to be going through all day today and also all day tomorrow. If it's morning where you are, evening or afternoon or anything in between, good morning, good evening, hello, and welcome. Are you ready, man? Like, I'm stoked.
I am.
This is a big thing,
well,
man.
So first of all, anyone that's on the stream that watched over the last 30-odd minutes that we were going through, you guys are funny. You guys are funny.
The chat room is on fire.
We
love it.
We were cracking up in here. You guys, oh my God. I'm in tears. And, yeah. And you know, my compliments to the AV guys in the back because the last 30 minutes of their lives were exciting.
Yes. I will say they had challenges, to say the least. They had challenges. But hey, we're here. We're good to go. And we are going to be talking about Windows Server 2012 R2, the what's new inside that particular solution. It's only been out for a couple of weeks, man. It's crazy.
Couple of weeks. Almost less than that.
Yeah, I guess you can say that. In case you haven't met me before, my name is Rick Claus. I'm a senior technical evangelist here at Microsoft. I've basically been working in the IT industry about 20-odd years. I was the guy that sat in front of the computer and had to jiggle the cable to get the printer to work. It was an HP 4L, I think it was. Remember those? Really old time ago?
Yeah, they were later in my career.
I know, eh? So we've been doing an awful lot of stuff, and I am the guy that basically is one of the server people here in Microsoft for Server 2012. Super stoked, and I'm joined by Mr. Corey Hines.
How you doing, everybody? I'm Corey. I'm crusty old geek.
Nice.
I've been around for quite a while. Rick says he's been around for 20 years. I claim I've been around for 15 years.
Yeah.
Reality is probably a little bit longer than that since I started tinkering with this stuff. But essentially, I'm a hoster. I have a company that does hosting. We do hosting for Hyper-V, for training, for demos, for labs, for classrooms, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And in my spare time, do this kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. you know, work with Microsoft to produce different types of educational marketing content and. Really an early adopter of just about everything, kind of on the bleeding edge. I'm one of the lucky few that I often get access to the bits before you do.
I know. I don't want to get into
that. Which is a point of jealousy and contention between us. Hey, Rick, have you seen? No, I haven't.
No, I haven't. I have to wait for the public stuff. So in case you haven't already done it, you can obviously go to the technet.microsoft.com/evalcenter and go and download a copy of Server 2012 R2, as well as System Center 2012 R2.
Absolutely.
As well. They're both in preview release, so you should not be using them inside a production environment. You don't have the license to do so. And also, there is we've already stated that there is no upgrade path from the preview to the finals, so you'll have to do a migration of the data and or reinstall if you decide to use that production. So generally, keep it for the lab, get used to it, go and understand what we're going to be doing for the rest of this week. You can follow along if you want to.
And everything we're doing here is running on the preview builds of everything, so... Fingers crossed, all bets are off. No guarantees. We're gonna kind of do our best and show you as much as we can and as many different things as we can as we kind of work through not only the what's specifically new, but some of the foundational stuff for 2012 as well.
You got it.
One of the things that I learned. So we just came back from TechEd, two mm-hmm. TechEd events, North America, Europe. I did a couple of pre-conference seminars in TechEd. So this is kind of like Europeans versus the North Americans. Now the heck with the rest of the world. I'm kidding. But so in terms of the Europeans versus the North Americans, I had about 250 people in each session. And so one of the first questions they asked was, how many people have deployed and are running 2012? Because the session was on 2012, not R2. It was a foundational, day of 2012. And in North America, we had about 3% of the room that said they were running on 2012.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe, we had about 75% of the room that said they were running on 2012.
So nice. Early adopters.
I don't know what that means, but just sort of an interesting thing. And what surprised me a little bit because I expected more people to be adopting 2012,
mm-hmm.
And more people have familiarity with 2012. And the thing to kind of remember is that R2 is a significant release. There's a lot in there, but it builds on the foundation of 2012. And if you don't have a solid foundation for 2012, a lot of what's in R2 is going to be really meaningless and pointless to you because you're not going to kind of see the difference or know what the difference is.
Right.
Some of it's obvious. Some of it is, just incremental, subtle, but very significant changes.
Right.
So big recommendation is, before you start really diving into R2, make sure you've got a good solid foundation for 2012. And a really good way to do that is to look at what we did last year.
Right.
We did this on 2012 at about the same sort of time in the release time frame.
Mm-hmm. It was a preview as well.
It was a preview. There was a little bit, I think about a month or two, we had to kind of get things ready as opposed to a week or so for this one.
Yeah.
But certainly you take a look at that, and that gives you a really solid 2012 foundation that's going to make a lot of the stuff that's in R2 be even that much more impressive and make a lot more sense.
Right. I noticed in the chat room there's been a couple of questions. In case you don't know, in the right-hand side, there's a small chat window. If you're interested, you can actually go with the multi-monitor setup and then click to, say, expand to make it into a large chat room, be able to see stuff. There's already been some questions about licensing and upgrades, that sort of stuff. Basically, Server 2012 R2, is a separate license to be able to buy, or unless you have SA, you would have rights to be able to use it when it goes into production. But you do not need to have new CALs for your endpoints. It's only for your users or for your devices. You only need to have a license to run the server in R2 as opposed to Windows Server 2012. So that's the one thing we've already stated before. It's good for you guys to know. If you flip to my sides for a second, I got some assumed knowledge that we kind of talked about. So you mentioned very, very rightly so, you were assuming that you have at least taken a look at Server 2012. If not, go off to MicrosoftVirtualAcademy.com and take a look at some of the content that's there. Take a look at the jumpstart that we did last year about Server 2012. At minimum, we're also assuming that you have 2008 R2 experience. And you're the type of person that basically gets in there, installs, configs, deploys and plays and works with this environment on a regular basis. You have some basic DNS information as well to understand how DNS goes off and works, and then you have obviously some experience with PowerShell, virtualization, and day-to-day management experience. Now, from an agenda that we're going to be covering today, you know, despite our slightly delayed start, we will still be covering this full agenda for where everything happens to go. We will be taking a look at Windows Server 2012 R2 as an overview. So the very first module is actually going to cover touching on a couple of points on all the other sections. So if you can only stay for one session, which I hope you can stay for the whole day, if you only stay for one session, the first one that we're doing right now is the one to basically be able to stay for. But then we go into much more depth into virtualization, into networking, and into storage is what we're covering today. And then tomorrow we're going to be covering management automation, VDI infrastructure, taking a little bit of break for lunch, and then coming back with access to information protection, or AIP as we like to call it internally, and then finally wrapping up with some web app stuff and everything else as well.
Cool. And so if I were to kind of sort of step back and look at that entire outline, pay particular attention to storage.
Yes.
Because starting with Windows Server 2012, the way you think about storage in Windows, the way you think about storage in your infrastructure, the way you think about storage in general fundamentally changes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first release of Windows where, you know, and I've been working with Windows since LAN Manager days. This is the first release of Windows where you can fundamentally re-architect the way you build a data center because of what they've put in the product.
Yeah.
Because it all has to do with cloud and the services around cloud and the increase in multi-tenancy across the board. But pay particular attention to the storage components, not just what we do here, which is some of the enhancements, but the fundamental storage changes around highly available file servers, file clusters, and all that stuff from 2012 in general.
Yep. So. And again, we'll be jumping back and forth between some slideware to give you some architecture and some background. We'll also be getting into a little bit of a diagramming thing if you still have the ability to go off and do some diagrams on lovely touch-based monitor. And just to kind of head off the questions, everyone always asks, what are these monitors? They are touch-based monitors from Wacom that are basically plugged into some laptops. Did they get the wrong name already?
They're plain on.
And they plug into some laptops off to the side. And so they're not an all-in-one. It's simply an add-on you can get yourself. And then we have them tilted at this weird angle that we have to get used to.
As I found out as I tried to plug a USB stick into the thing, there's no ports on it.
It's a monitor. It's a monitor. So, shall we get started, my friend?
I don't.
Are you ready? Any last closing comments before we start?
No, not really. You can go ahead.
No, go
ahead. By all means, I'll sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
Nice. Well, I do want to put this slide up here just for a minute, give you guys a reminder about some of the resources that we had. You'll see this slide come up a number of different times. If you're on the Twitters, MVA Jumpstart is the one that shows up on the sidebar in case you're interested. And then if you take a look at some other streams, I have another one open here that is up there in the corner, which is WS2012R2JS as one way that I follow what the heck's going on.
And you can Twitter to Rick or myself directly, yes. Or Breaking news. You can Twitter Rick's hat now.
Yes, someone actually created a Twitter account.
There's a Twitter account for Rick's hat. So nice. If you want to know what life is like sitting up there, you can Twitter Rick's hat, and I'm sure it'll tell you all sorts of weird and wonderful, interesting things.
Oh, great.
I've always wondered what keeps moving around under there, because I keep seeing it shifting around on your head when your hands are not touching it. So,
oh, you guys are killing me. Back on the slide again, just for the other resource links there, in case you're looking to download a copy of Windows Server 2012 R2 Preview, aka.ms/ws2012r2, and also System Center 2012r2 Preview is aka.ms/sc2012r2. And then, like as we mentioned before, there's a large amount of information available for on-demand stuff, and this will actually appear on demand there as well at MicrosoftVirtualAcademy.com. And a plug for my friend Simon Perryman, he has a jumpstart coming up next week specifically on System Center 2012 R2, like this one, on July 15th, and you can register at aka.ms/scr2js.
We're going to do a little bit with Virtual Machine Manager over the next 2 days,
right,
because it's such an integral part of the storage networking and virtualization solution,
yep,
which is part of Windows.
It's your fabric controller,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but we're not going into depth on
right.
VMM. We're going to kind of glaze it over a little bit. So if you're looking at some of the VMM stuff and going, but what is that? That's what Simon's going to do next week. They're going to go deep into it. So you'll get a little taste of it here as we kind of point out. As an example, some of the components of Hyper-V are only manageable through VMM now.
Yeah.
Some of those more abstract and complex functions like network virtualization, for example, they don't do anything in the UI in Windows. It's 100% in the UI in VMM. And so we'll kind of glaze through a little bit of that, and they'll get more into that next week.
Oh, and I see here from our lovely chat back and forth, it's a planar monitor, PCT2785, in case you are interested. We'll go on from there. But let's go and take a look at the slides here just to give you a bit of an agenda for this first section here. We're going to be looking at some background on what the Cloud OS is and how that all works from a Microsoft perspective and what we're calling Server 2012 R2. We'll look at some basic challenges and opportunities you guys are facing these days. And then, more importantly, we break it into each of the major sections that we'll be talking about today.
So bottom line, guys, if you watch nothing else and you just kind of want a quick hit, okay, R2, what is it? What's the big deal?
Yep.
This is the one to watch.
You got it.
We'd like it hanging around the rest of the day, but this is kind of the one to watch if you just want the big, what's the big deal with R2?
And if you, besides interacting on the Twitter side of things, you obviously have a chat availability. We have a whole team of people from around the world answering questions about Server 2012 R2. Both MVPs and Microsoft employees and also members of the product team are there as well. And we're there as well when we're not actually talking at this point in time. So don't forget the chat room there too. So back in the slides for a second here, just look at some transformational trends. Basically, there's a whole realm of trends that are going on inside the industry right now with regards to cloud computing. Consumerization of IT with bringing your own devices, big massive amounts of data explosion that's going on. And basically, if you tend to break down how people are looking at data centers and how people are looking at their environment these days, you can almost think of it as, regardless of the size of your organization, you're basically managing and looking after your compute resources, storage resources, and networking resources. You're not just looking after a server or a workload or something like that. It's basically a combination of those three that you have to juggle and balance to find the right environment. And it's the same as if you're a very large hosting company or as if you're a very small
mom-and-pop shop. At the end of the day, the transition that's happening now is from silos of responsibility to layers or tiers of responsibility.
You got it.
And the tools and the thinking and the architecture that you build is no longer, how do I build a server that someone administers top to bottom and make that easy for them, but how do I build a layer that someone administers side to side, mm-hmm. and they can scale out versus scaling up. There was a big push for scaling up. Now we're kind of a push for scaling out and doing it in layers. So I care about this layer, you care about that layer, someone else cares about this layer. But it's a different way of thinking about, how you approach network design, data center design, service design.
Yeah. So from a background perspective, the concept of what we're calling the Cloud OS basically is taking our knowledge that we have garnered and brought up from running multiple data centers, multiple very large properties, and bringing those learnings from the large-scale environments of the public data centers that we're running and bringing that into our operating system. So you'll see us abstracting the disk. You'll see us abstracting the network. You'll see us bringing in a layer of resiliency and high availability to these different areas and being able to then go in, as you mentioned, talk about these layers that you go and go off and manage. And the idea is that you're able to go off and transform your data center into a more manageable environment, a more automated environment to be able to go off and to get those different jobs and responsibilities done. So the good thing about this is that if you already are working with and using Windows technologies, you can already take your skills you have and bring them into this new environment and know that you'll be able to continue to work using the tools that you're used to working with.
What does Azure run on?
Azure actually runs on Server 2012,
right,
up in the cloud, and has we'll actually be touching on that a little bit throughout this entire next 2 days.
Yeah, a lot of people think Azure runs on something different.
Yeah,
it doesn't. It runs on just plain old Windows Server 2012.
Yeah, it's got a lot of customization going on to be able to make it work at this different level. But there's actually some really cool things we've made available with the release of 2012 R2,
yep,
you can actually go in and run your own infrastructure as a service with your own private cloud implementation with something that we call the Windows Azure Pack, which allows you to basically have like an Azure administrative portal to be able to go off and provision services, templates, applications.
It's my Azure.
Yeah. It's really, really neat stuff. Just going in here from a experience, as I mentioned, we're bringing in the content of what we've learned in a large data center, bringing that inside our own environment from Windows Server and making it available to you for where it happens to sit. Some things we brought in, basically some high performance in the industry, standard hardware, file-based storage, storage spaces, automatic tiering is some new stuff we'll be looking at this week. Multi-tenant environments, in case you happen to deal with very large environments that have multiple customers you need to isolate from each other. The ability to go through and do some very cool stuff with software-defined networking, both at the virtualization layer and even now at the physical layer as well, for being able to control those switches in an automated fashion. Policy-based administration, delegation that goes out, and then finally doing some very cool stuff on the web side of things. So from a challenges perspective, you know, we're all faced with the whole concept of shrinking IT budgets and trying to figure out how to provide more of a business value into your organization. And the idea is trying to run your data centers, regardless of their size, in a more optimized fashion, in a way to be able to go off and to reduce your operational costs that are inside your environment. We have the ability to go through and, you know, mandate of trying to keep the lights on all the time and trying to make it so that you have the ability to dynamically scale out and scale up your different resources of these different layers back up inside your system. I was talking with Jeffrey Snover a little while ago at one of the interviews at TechEd North America, and he was talking about making, like, to use an analogy, like a plug and play of the cloud environment, where you simply plug in your data or not, you plug in your compute or not into that type of cloud environment to be able to work with it. Like, literally, it's like three clouds these days.
Yeah, I mean, this whole notion that you can define a service model, you can define a configuration, which we'll talk about tomorrow, something called desired configuration management, and just kind of say, this is what I want, and it's the same whether it's private, whether it's hosted service provider, or whether it's public.
Yep.
And you just say, this is what I want, and any one of the three. And that's kind of the end goal for all of this, that things can move from any one of those environments to the other without any need for change.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because at the end of the day, change is our worst enemy, right? That's when downtime happens. That's when things go wrong. You try to change something.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm pretty sure that's what happened this morning. We changed the stream. We added people to it.
I guess that could be it, too.
Your fault. Don't blame us. Your fault.
Nice. Take a look at the slides here from an overview perspective of Server 2012. This is how we're basically laying this out for the rest of the next day and a half to 2 days. We're going to be talking about virtualization with different levels of performance. Again, think of that as your compute nodes being able to go off and more efficiently use your resources. We'll be talking about storage, as you mentioned. We're going to save that till the end of the day with some high performance capabilities at storage level without having to have the high performance pricing associated with it as well. It's built-in box. Networking is very wrap up as well for the rest of today for the topics that we're covering. And then tomorrow we're going to be looking at server automation and management, access and information protection, virtual desktop and VDI infrastructure, and then wrapping it up with a little bit of web and application platform as well.
Sounds awesome. Can I get in a lot of trouble right now?
Well, you always get in a lot of trouble.
Look at me very closely for a second. SANs are dead. More on that later.
Nice. Details at 11. Nice. Server virtualization is our first main area we're going to be covering off. New levels of performance and cross-platform support for how this works. But basically, the idea of having, is it critical? Is it enterprise class, enterprise scale available? And absolutely, with 2012, we already blew out the doors as far as our limits and capacities are concerned from a non-virtualizable workload doesn't exist anymore with the virtualization platform these days.
Well, I really don't like this whole question of, is it enterprise grade?
Yeah.
I think what Hyper-V does now defines enterprise grade.
Yeah, a good point.
So I think you need to be looking at everything else and going, is it enterprise grade, not the other way around.
And we also tie into a lot of the hardware architecture for being able to do a lot of offloading. With RDMA as an example, to be able to go off and to get a lot of throughput transfer between different systems. So definitely, we're going to be doing a big section here on enterprise class scale. And again, not a lot of changes from scale capabilities from 2012 to 2012 R2.
But, I mean,
it's more of how it leverages different pieces.
Yeah, the scale is not, oh, I can build a bigger server, I can build a bigger VM, I can build more memory. The scale improvements are now, I can take that and make it run faster by taking advantage of assorted hardware offloading capabilities and doing some things that are a little more intelligent inside of the VMs inside of the hosts. Like, for example, virtual receive-side scaling. Which is a new thing that we'll get into later on.
Virtual machine mobility, we already were leading the way with being able to do a shared nothing live migration. You literally simply would have a Ethernet cable between two systems that were not connected to shared storage, not connected to a SAN environment, direct attached storage if you wanted to, and are able to move the workload between them.
There's a very big important thing to kind of talk to and point out about that.
Yep.
Jump on my screen for a second, guys. So first of all, a lot of people may not have seen Shared Nothing Live Migration. It's, you know, and if you haven't, basically what I have here is I have a VM running on a host. It's not in a cluster. There's nothing shared. It's just local running disk. If I look at the settings in the VM, look, it's a, you know, here it is, a local running disk. And I can now take that and I can move it to another host. So we just go in here and we go, all right, let's take it and let's move it. So we'll go move the virtual machine. Now, the storage live migration is something else a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
The notion that, you know, you have ultimate virtual machine flexibility in here. You can move the VM, you can move the disks, you can reposition, you can do anything you want without any downtime. It doesn't matter. You don't need to go offline to do this. So move virtual machine, new host I want to move it to. We'll just pick another server. I've got host 3. Hit next a couple of times, move the data to a single location. We can be selective, saying the snapshots are on this volume, the VHDs are on this volume.
Based on performance.
The storage is on this volume. And that actually comes into play when you start getting into things like storage tiering, because you can choose different, and with storage tiering, the new write-back caching, you can choose which volumes are best suited for the type of data. In VDI scenarios, which we're going to talk about tomorrow, where you position, for example, in a pooled VDI scenario, the base VHD, the gold VHD, versus the differencing disk that get created, you can, you know, reposition those things after the fact if all of a sudden you need bigger, faster, better storage, for example. Destination folder. Pick a folder.
Again, he's using local storage again.
Yep,
this is
local storage again.
Shared amongst these two guys.
Yep, it's local DAS to local DAS finish, and that'll kind of chug off and start sending the VM across the wire. And if I look at host 3, you'll see a little spike in the network here once that migration actually starts. So there it is right there.
Yep.
For those of you that watched the last one of these we did, I had really cool hardware. I don't have really cool hardware this time. I've kind of got...
What are you talking about? There's some very cool hardware there. We're not using it right now.
Well...
The other cool stuff.
Oh, the other cool stuff, yes. But like my whole... I had like 56 gig Mellanox last time. I don't have... All that cool hardware is still on the trucks back from Ticket Europe.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We're kind of
we had to repurpose stuff to be able to make
this
happen.
Yeah, we're kind of running on the grade 2 stuff. So that's moving. Now, here's the really important thing about this. You can now live migrate, shared nothing live migrate, or cluster live migrate cross version. So I can go from 2012 to 2012 R2.
So you can go with a production 2012 Hyper-V environment that you implement today.
Right.
And then you can play around with the pre-production, pre-release version of 2012 R2.
Yep.
Get comfortable with it. You can try doing some moves back and forth. But then when you're ready to go into the production version, you don't have to do a export and import. You don't have to do anything else like that. It literally is a live migration.
It's a no downtime upgrade for VMs.
Nice.
So if you want to go from 2012 to 2012 R2, you can't do obviously an in place upgrade with VMs running.
Right.
But you can do a shared nothing live migrate up to a server running R2 while a VM is running, upgrade the 2012 server and then live migrate back, or choose not to. Point being, the save states are compatible.
Nice.
I can go from a 2012 cluster, do a shared nothing live migration, to a 2012 R2 cluster. You can't go down.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's a one-way.
It's a one-way up. You can go up. But point being, if you have a Cloud Fabric, you know, one of the big issues that a lot of people had with this stuff was, you know, hey, you know, if it's a new version, I don't want to take a data center-wide downtime to put all these in place. I don't want to take customer VMs offline because that, you know, if you're multi-tenant and you got things, it's a nightmare to try and schedule this.
Right.
You don't have to now. All you've got to do is stand up your 2012 and your 2012 R2 environment, live migrate to it, and then upgrade or discard, your choice.
Nice.
No downtime. So that's big. That's a big deal.
Now, we do have to clarify that that feature, that functionality is not available if you're running 2008 R2, the
right.
previous version.
Right. It's 2012 to 2012 R2.
Let's be very clear because I know we're going to get questions about it.
We said that in sync that time.
I know.
That
was,
I think we had to shake pinkies now. Don't we?
Back on my slides here, just to kind of wrap this guy up from a virtualization perspective, you kind of jumped into the demo. That's actually the next section there. But don't forget, we also have first-class citizens support for Linux and Linux environments. We cover about 86% of the popular distros with the enhancements or enlightenments of Hyper-V. Bits you need to have the full functionality has been involved in the Linux kernel since 2.6.1. And then any distro that supports that is has them built in. And then obviously we support a wider range of them, up to 86% of them or so. So they're in there too. And we might be able to show some of that. We might not have asked you if we don't have a VM ready to go for that.
No, I don't. I tried.
It is support. It's all there.
And now, there's what's cool and new. Dynamic memory for Linux.
Right. We'll save that for the virtualization section. We're getting there, man. This is still the introduction. Don't give everything away.
Don't slow me down. Away. I'm excited. Come on, Rick.
Back here at the slides for 1 second here. The high performance live migration, basically, as you mentioned, between the network adapters, we do hardware offload CPU offload to the different cards for being able to do live migration with RDMA. We do also migration between the two systems in a faster fashion. We'll talk about this later in the virtualization section, with the option of going through compression. Because if you have available CPU cycles, why not compress the stuff and move it across and bring it back up again, decompressed on the other side, to be able to speed things up.
And here's another fundamental shift that you know, you guys that are architecting new data center fabrics need to kind of keep in mind. The CPU has never been the bottleneck.
Right.
The CPU is becoming the bottleneck. As you get into 10 gig and higher and team 10 gig.
And multiple sessions.
And multiple sessions and all that stuff.
With SMB3.
The CPU can become the bottleneck.
Yeah.
That's why offloading becomes so important. And so when you're looking at purchasing hardware, offloading, which was always sort of an afterthought in the past, has to come to the forefront of your mind now. When you're looking at card, do they support SMB Direct RDMA? Do they support offloading? Do they support VMQ, SRIOV? And you've got to take those hardware things into consideration because the CPU is becoming the bottleneck. In fact, there was a demo that the guys did at TechEd. And we'll talk about TechEd a little bit because there's some phenomenal resources there and you know how we kind of incorporate some of that in here. But they actually were doing live migrations so quick that the bottleneck became memory.
Yep. I mean, I remember they were talking about the whole concept of the automated testing that goes on.
Yeah.
They implemented RDMA as an option for being able to do transfer between two hosts. It was happening so quick. One of the tests is to actually cancel live migration in process of the migration to make sure that it's able to recover and still work. They couldn't cancel it fast enough with the automated tests, so they came in the next day and all these tests had failed is because they couldn't cancel live migration because they had completed too quickly.
Yeah.
So very, very cool stuff. From a slide perspective, just this actually covers through a nice little animation of how this particular workload migration works for shared nothing live migration. You've got the live migration request that goes on. You've got an IP connection. It sends over the configuration data. The machine is still running and talking to the source drive. Everything's all still good. It then goes off and basically starts the ability to go through and send writes and data over to the destination device. It then now all new writes basically goes to both devices while it's still going on. It then goes through and brings over the memory content to the other side as well. It then goes through and does modified memory pages after that fact to make sure everything's all in sync. And basically, magically, when it knows everything's in sync, boom, it makes the cutover within the TCP window as if nothing had happened.
25 milliseconds is TCP window that you've got to get under.
And that's the standard that they use in the industry.
Now, question that's come up about 45 times
already
since
good
we started that. I didn't quite exact, 43 maybe. Can you live migrate Intel to AMD? No, you can't. It's got to be family to family. So right. you go Intel, Intel, AMD, AMD. And there's a flag within the VM. And jump down to the screen real quick. If I go to the settings of a VM, go to the processor under compatibility, there's this VM's running, so I can't check it. You can only do this on a VM that's powered off. So you got my personal best practice is every VM I create, I set this just right. in the box, which is migrate to a different processor version. What this does is on a CPU, the CPU typically exposes certain feature sets like, I don't even remember what, like MMX and SSX and all these, audio, video optimizations that different makes and models of CPU, typically consumer-grade CPUs have. It limits those to create a baseline of compatibility so you can bounce from, one generation to another generation of a processor, but it's Intel, AMD.
Yeah, it's still in the same family.
Because their architectures are too fundamentally different.
Yep. The last little piece we have, I do believe, about virtualization is talking about dynamic memory and where dynamic memory fits.
And so yeah, I ruined that.
I know. It's like the idea basically is that dynamic memory has not changed from 2012 to 2012 R2. The addition that's new is the fact that now Linux has the ability to take advantage of dynamic memory. The idea is that you basically set a minimum memory and a maximum memory on your machines, and you turn on dynamic memory as well, and then the server host of the machine decides what's available and shown to the actual operating system to be able to use it, and then potentially is able to go and use more and then take it away as it needs to without the guest OS really caring or knowing that this is going on. It's always a step ahead of the game for where it is. And then also some benefits for it. We have this other thing that happens to be called smart paging, where basically you set a startup amount of RAM for a system. If the memory resources, you can see there, VMM at the far end side there is not currently turned on, there's not enough memory available on the system to be able to start it, you're able to go through and use what's known as smart paging, where basically it is able to go in and temporarily increase the amount of memory available to that one machine so it hits its startup environment, but it actually uses the page file to substitute because it's only starting up.
Yeah.
And then as it is finished initializing, it then goes in and rebalances stuff to get rid of those smart paging files, memory references to not impact performance amongst the different machines. So right. it scavenges
so,
memory back.
Yeah, and so take a look down for a second over here. Again, settings of a VM under memory. You can change the minimum maximum RAM values while the machine's running and
right.
the buffer value. You can change the startup while it's running. So some of these are going to be set initially. But this is where you would actually configure that. And
right.
so your minimum is the least it could ever possibly have. Max is as big as it can go.
Yep.
Startup is what it's going to be given when it's booting.
Yep.
One little example of where this comes into practical use is if you're doing OS deployment to VMs mm-hmm. using WinPE. WinPE requires a gig, but Windows requires less than a gig. And so if you build, you build a VM for Windows and you put like 512 in it, like I typically start when I build VMs, and you then try to drop Windows PE to deploy something to it, Windows PE goes, I don't have enough memory.
Right.
And so this is a way to get around it, is to do the initial startup.
It changes the way you do your machine design when you're doing stuff.
Yeah.
I literally just say, here's the defaults, and then I got dynamic memory turned on, and I'm done. Like, I let the host decide the amount of RAM that the guy actually gets to use.
And there's some pretty common, and feel free to tell me, save this for later.
It for later. There you go. That's that. Because we're moving into networking next. Because we have a whole section just on vert, man. We're giving too much. We both love virtualization. We got to save it for the next section.
Yes,
this
Dad.
Was the teaser. This was the teaser. The next section we're talking about is networking.
I've been beaten with a stick.
The next section is networking. So for networking perspective, the idea is that we've got... this was, again, available in 2012, but now is now available in 2012 R2, and the 2012 R2 piece is it actually bridges the gap between virtual networking that's software-defined and even physical switches as well, being able to manage them all together as one with that fabric management tool that we've been talking about, which is SCVMM, System-Centered Virtual
and
Machine Management.
Software-defined networking is not just network virtualization. It's
right.
things beyond that. It's some new things that are rolling in. Like, for example, there are some relatively cryptic methods for administering switches, for example. You can now with PowerShell turn off a switch port
right.
on a physical switch if the switch supports the standards.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's all these vendors now beginning to support these new standards for hardware-based management that PowerShell leverages through WMI and through SIM. So you get a level of control now that you didn't have before. And that's, what's often called this data center abstraction layer.
Yep.
Where I can use PowerShell to configure a switch to IPMI boot a server. And we'll look at some of that stuff tomorrow. stick around.
You got it. From a networking perspective as well, we have high-performance networking with basically offloads to the different cards that are there, with single-root I/O virtualization now supported with live migration, the ability to do with NIC teaming, load balancing between the different NICs that are in there more efficiently.
Teaming's gotten better.
Yes, it's gotten better.
Teaming in 2012 was phenomenal. It was like, in my world, it was an absolute lifesaver because I could run one PowerShell command and I could team 70 servers and I could have redundancy on 70 servers.
Yeah.
But the algorithms that were used within teaming weren't as efficient as they are now. So they've changed some of the teaming algorithms a bit. It's one of those subtle but significant things.
Right.
That it's very difficult to show you this, but I can show you where you can configure it.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, with improved manageability and diagnostics, as you mentioned, we now have hooks into the machines to be able to go off and do resource metering, to be able to find out what different resources are being used, and then also do look back and charge back if you wanted to. We also have virtual IP address management now capable with our IPAM solution. Quaz was already there. DNS traffic was already there as well.
Yep.
So generally, again, some slight improvements and tweaks here and there between the 2012 and the R2 versions. Where they
raise your hand if you've deployed IPAM. Good. Okay.
Everyone's got in the room here.
About half the people out there have deployed it. I can tell. So, you know, some guy's sitting at home right now at his computer, and he's gone like this, and his wife's going, "Why don't you put your hand in the air?"
We can see you. You don't know this. We can see you. Software-defined networking. That's the first section that we talk about. It's a very big discussion in the industry right now with software-defined networking. We've been doing it for a while, since 2012, so we're not new to this game. We've now enhanced it even more with what we're doing. And literally, you have blue company and red company with the same internal IP addressing that you now need to onboard or work with or do stuff with, and they are able to go off and have the ability to run on the same subnet as the host environment for virtualization, and then have the ability to coexist without realizing that they're coexisting in the same environment.
Can I make a random pointless comment?
Sure.
On the slide, there's an acronym, BYOIP.
Yeah, I love that one.
Right? And so, obviously, we've all heard BYOB. I go to a party, we bring my own beer, right? And that eventually got picked up because, most IT guys are,
bring your own device,
quite
BYOD.
Quite frankly, heavy drinkers. We have to be to get through some stuff. So they can bring your own device. Now you have a bring your own IP. I want to host a bring your own IP party. You can't come to my party unless
you
bring an IP.
I'll make sure I bring my IPv6 address in GUID with me.
You don't get in the door unless you have an IP address.
What is your address?
Nobody's going to turn up.
You got it. 127.0.0.1, my friend.
That's ::1.
You got it.
get with the modern times.
You got it. Now, you mentioned NIC teaming. NIC teaming was available in 2012. The main thing that we have is an enhancement to LBFO for doing load balancing between them. Instead of the main thing that the NIC teaming was done is we bring all the drivers in-house. We don't have any proprietary drivers that are being used. It's the drivers to the manufacturers. And then there's no teaming software required from the manufacturer anymore. It's done in-house with the operating system. I've actually met the PM in charge of this. He's got like a NIC team of 32 different vendors that he's made. And it's fully supported.
It's one of those because I can.
Yeah, because you can kind of thing. But again, it's vendor agnostic, and it gives you the ability to have management through UI, management through PowerShell, as you mentioned. And the biggest thing that it handles and looks after is when a particular NIC fails or a particular NIC becomes unplugged. So it's a resiliency thing, which is usually the cause of human error. If someone unplugs something or else the machine breaks, it still continues to run.
Fishing around in the back of the rack trying to bring the new server online.
And then they didn't realize they unplugged three different servers by mistake.
Or bumped them. You had the network card, but you had a half-height slot, but a full-height card, so you had to pull the protective clip off it. Now it's just sitting in there being held by the PCI bus only.
Oh, nice. You seem like you've done this before.
No, I haven't.
You've had a troubleshooter
before?
The guy
that used to work for me did.
Oh, okay, nice. So NIC teaming basically is able to go through and handle the failure and just keep on working as it should on the different systems.
Now, we'll talk a little bit in depth about NIC teaming in the network section
yes.
and kind of do some background on NIC teaming because it's important to understand where this fits in and kind of how it works.
Virtual IP addressing, same thing we'll be covering in the networking section as well.
And NIC teaming can be passed up into the VMs, but that's just a host thing. You can actually shove the team right up into the VMs themselves. And there's reasons you would do one versus the other.
Now, IPAM is an inbox feature. It was there with 2012. It's been improved upon with 2012 R2. And one of the things it does is also it does the virtualized IP address space management as well, not just the physical stuff.
Right, and that's the big change for R2 is IPAM now can handle, can address virtual networks as opposed to physical networks. which obviously with when you deal with Hyper-V network virtualization, that becomes an important thing.
Yep.
And, you know, IPAM, if you're not familiar with IPAM, fundamentally what it is, it's a single pane of glass for IP address services, which include Active Directory,
right,
DNS, and DHCP.
It also does network policy servers.
Network policy servers as
well. And it also is able to import and export from third-party solutions as well, if you wanted to, because it is PowerShell-based and handles CSV files.
And it's basically backed by a database.
Yeah, I call it, it's the what I call the humanization. It's a bad word, it doesn't exist, but it puts your human aspect of how you manage your network into a knowledge environment that you then can say, oh, I need to deploy a new machine in Building 26. I don't need to remember what IP address range it is or what range I have to put my servers versus my desktops versus my workstations in. It just knows Building 26 in this particular block.
Yeah, which server runs DHCP? And why, you know, I've got some scopes over here. You know, I've got a subnet and I've got, you know, somewhere on this, somewhere over here, somewhere here. And how does it all kind of bring together? It also now handles DHCP failover, which it didn't before. So there's some big changes there.
Now, we mentioned storage being a very big investment and a big change area as well. I'm just going to build a slide out so you guys can see it all at once here. But basically, high-performance storage on industry-standard hardware, storage spaces is the main way to be able to do this, and then the ability to go through and talk to JBOD-type enclosures to be able to have enterprise-class performance.
SANs are dead.
Stuff that's out there.
Don't hate me. I'll explain. No, I'm not 100% right. SANs are not gone away. They didn't just vanish. But as we talk about this next-generation architecture, the definition of what a SAN is can change quite a bit, and you can save a ton of money.
I anticipate that we'll be doing some whiteboarding during this section.
We'll do a little bit, and you know, I anticipate that I'm probably going to have some haters on the little chat line when I say that, and that's fine. Rick's my friend. I'm good.
Now, from a networking stack as well, although it's on the file server side of things, SMB3, massive changes happened from 2008R2 to 2012. Mm-hmm. Basically, SMB3 came out. It's been incremented a small number. I think it's 3.01 or 3.02 or something like that.
And I mean, you know, let's make no mistake here. From SMB 2.2 to SMB3 was about 15 versions worth of change.
Oh, it's massive amount of change.
And if you want to boil it down to one thing, right, what did SMB3 do that SMB2 didn't? One single scenario. SMB3 supports server-based file shares.
Right.
That's a really bad way to describe it, because aren't all shares
They're all server-based.
Server data on file shares.
Workloads.
Yeah, server workloads on file shares. Server files on file shares. So files that are opened.
Your virtualization VHD files.
Files that are opened and locked.
And locked and working with
for
multiple
years
handles.
At a time.
Right.
Not while you save the Word doc.
Yeah.
And that scenario enables so much.
Multiple sessions into that data point, multiple servers having that open at the same time, being able to hand stuff back and forth without dropping stuff,
and so we'll
scale more stuff out. Phenomenal stuff. We're both storage guys. We love it. And then finally, the last bit of it, simply management and backup. We'll talk about VHDX files, the changes there, quality of service, and also some online cloud services as well. Now, you mentioned this earlier. Save this again for the storage area, but the biggest change from 2012 to 2012R2 is the ability to go through and have tiers of performance inside a storage space of mixed drive media. It's SSD and spindles that spin. That's basically the differentiator between a tier you're able to establish.
Do not confuse this with caching.
Right.
Okay.
This is different.
Caching is something different. We'll dig into more of that when we do the storage section. But tiering is a phenomenal improvement that allows you to have, you know, the term that's tossed around is low cost per IOP, to keep dollars per IOP down. Because when you're measuring storage cost in a large data center, that's typically what you're looking at is what's the dollars per IOP? How many IOPs do I get? What does that cost me? And if you get that number down, then you save a lot of money. Storage is for most people's IT budgets, 60%, thereabouts. It is for mine. And as we start to migrate our services onto some of these new things in 2012, 2012R2, we're seeing that dollar per IOP figure get cut in half.
Yep.
Without any loss of performance, and in fact with gains in flexibility. So lots on tiering as we dig in a little bit later on. We'll show you some cool demos on it. You'll actually see the tiers move around, and then we'll dive into what the actual difference between caching and tiering is, and when you potentially use one versus the other. So there you go.
very cool stuff on the storage tiering side of things. We've got some great. He's teased me with a demo performance thing last night as we're getting ready for this, and he won't tell me what it is until we get to the storage
section. I did.
So I don't even know what he's going to talk
about. So if you go, and I mentioned this before, like, so if you, TechEd just ended. All yes. The sessions for TechEd are online.
Right. There's a channelline.msdn.com/events/TechEd. And you can pick North America or Europe.
Or northamerica.mstech.com.
Yeah, that works.
Just saying. So are there one of those you can watch the sessions? And there's a lot of sessions that there were folks did some really cool performance demos on storage tiering. And we've got some video snips here. If we get some time, we may pull in and just kind of take a look at so you can see them. But we wanted to do, you know, as we went through this, stuff that wasn't done there. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise we're just repeating the same stuff over and over again.
Right.
That's not doing you guys a justice. So I came up with a cool little storage tiering demo. I think you'll really dig.
Okay, man.
But you'll have to wait and find out.
Someone was talking about, actually in the chat rooms, about replication, with being able to set up a replica in Hyper-V from box A to box B.
We're going to cover that in the next
section. We're
going to
be covering that in virtualization.
And to box... We'll get there.
Well, I was just going to say, it now is able to go off and do to a third level, and we even have the ability to go through and have a outside monitoring solution. Azure Hyper-V Recovery Manager is the name of it, that ties in your System Center environment that can go through and coordinate the moving of resources from one particular data center to the other. Now, the data doesn't actually move up to Azure and down again. It simply is coordinated the replication between the two different sites, and then handles health monitoring. If there's a problem with it, it then goes in and kicks off the automated process to basically fail it over to the other side. So very, very cool stuff. And just to be absolutely clear, because this slide was not made by myself, it does say Exchange on the bottom of that. And Exchange, if you talk to any Exchange product teams, Exchange does not support Hyper-V Replica. Because it has its own built-in replication
Exchange
capabilities.
They've always been a little stubborn when it comes to virtualization anyway for some reason. They've been a little, I don't know.
It's a first-class citizen.
It is.
Best workload on Hyper-V. We run it the best and the fastest. Yep. Just some of the advanced functionality that we have, for instance, the replica, isn't supported because of the way that they write their database. And yep. they don't have the ability to go off and change that just like this. So basically, you're at this point in time. There was a question that came up in the chat room. Is Exchange supported as a Hyper-V replica candidate from one to the other by the Exchange team? The answer is no, it is not.
Now, so here's a really important thing too, right? Because this has always caused contention whenever I go talk to customers and you know, they talk to other virtualization vendors and they talk to Microsoft, and so someone asks a question, is this supported? And Microsoft goes, no, and someone else goes, yes. The definition of supported, according to Microsoft, is you can call the 1-800 hotline and they will say, yes, we'll help you. Not, it will work.
Right.
There is a ton of stuff that will work that is not supported that by other definitions is called supported. So supported, you know, gotta clarify that. You know, yes, it will work. Okay, well, if I call you, will you fix it if it broke? No, I won't. Well, then it's not supported. It functions.
Right.
And everything functions under Hyper-V, but it's not all supported. So important clarity point.
Management is the next section that we're going to be covering. This actually has been kicking off day two. And that's where we're going to be talking about standards-based management with the management framework, which mm-hmm. basically is a consistent framework that now all the different management functionality from both a developer perspective, an IT pro perspective, an automation perspective ties into the WMF and then down to the different parts you're going to go off and manage as a single entry point. Multi-server management with a server manager. We'll be doing some brief stuff with System Center, but we'll be leaving the System Center stuff till next week's jumpstart.
Yep. We'll also do some things with Server Manager, just make sure everyone's familiar with Server Manager, because that's a massive update. And most people that I've seen that even deployed 2012 are not using Server Manager anywhere near to the potential they could.
Which is crazy to me. And you should be running that Server Manager tool on a Windows 8 or Windows 8.1 workstation, not from the console of the server, because you can do everything from the remote Windows 8 or Windows 8.1 client to those servers that you're managing. And it also does down-level management of previous versions down to 2008 versions as well. And then finally, automation, obviously with PowerShell, we'll be talking about some desired state configuration. We'll be talking about the new robustness of PowerShell. An extra couple of hundred PowerShell commandlets have been added to 2012 R2.
You want to see something right now?
Sure, man. We can talk about slides. We can do a quick little one.
So PowerShell, right? So the big thing we're going to show tomorrow with PowerShell is desired state configuration. And so we'll obviously get to that tomorrow. But one of the cool little things they've added with PowerShell, there's not a lot that's changed in the language of PowerShell, mm-hmm. in the syntax of the structure for PowerShell 4, which is R2 8.1, for PowerShell 3, which was R2 and 8, or sorry, 2012 R2 and 8, 2012 and Windows 8. Alphabet soup here. There was a lot of syntactual. Is that even a word?
Is that a word?
It is now.
We're making
syntactual changes for PowerShell. But one of the neat little nifty things they added was with PowerShell Web Access. Now, if you've never seen PowerShell Web Access, this was there in 2012. But there's a new little thing in R2, which I'll go ahead and log on and just hit a server on the network. So this is, you know, PowerShell in a web browser, mm-hmm. which makes the security guys go crazy.
It's done through SSL. It's a secure environment. You have all the standard security parameters associated with the machines, but PowerShell commands you can run.
Fair enough. But if you go to your non-Windows security guy and say, hey, I want to put a command line that accesses everything published via web server, they get all squirrely with you. So you just got to explain to them.
It's really
human
factor.
So this is PowerShell in a web browser. And if I go host
any standards-based web browser, this is working, by the way.
It's HTML5.
Yeah.
So here's the name of my server, and I can set a variable. Why do I always spell it that way?
There you go.
Which, you know, okay, that's about the world's dumbest PowerShell demo. But there's a new button called Save. And what that does is it disconnects me from PowerShell. But it saves the session. So I can now go back, log in again.
Same user, same machine you're trying to get to.
Go back to the same server, and what it's going to do now is say, hey, you've already got a session running. And I click it, and I go, cool, here's my session, and there's my variable again.
Nice. Pick it right back
now,
up where
you left. Now, here's why that's important, right? A lot of people say PowerShell, when I first show PowerShell Web Access, they go, PowerShell Web Access, cool, great, but where would I ever use this? Think about as you move to cloud scenarios where you no longer have RPC type access, or you maybe don't have WSMan type access.
Yep.
Maybe all you've got is SSL, HTTPS. This allows you to shove PowerShell and everything about PowerShell over essentially web-friendly connections,
yep.
which can get you into places you know you may not have been able to get into before just because of all the layers and rules and whatnot. So that's all fine and good. So if you write a management tool that goes against PowerShell Web Access, a graphical tool, but you're going over a WAN link, so the connection's by definition not trustworthy, and the connection goes down, and the tool crashes. This allows you to have a tool that can start a job and handle disconnects.
Yep.
So for you as an administrator, you're probably not going to do this, but if you're an ISV and you're looking at building PowerShell-based admin tools, then this is a really neat thing you want to take a look at because it allows you to build essentially a connectionless admin tool that can connect, send a bunch of PowerShell, let it run the session, and then disconnect. Or, you know, maybe not disconnect, but handle a disconnect, and then reconnect and pick up where it left off. So you can actually build some really neat tools around this. And if I were a betting man, which I'm not typically, but sometimes I am, and this is purely 100% my speculation, I'd say you're going to see...
Do you want to get a speculation,
man? I'm speculating. You work for Microsoft. I don't. I think down the road you'll see server manager do something like this. I really do. I think that down the road, I don't think it's going to be in R2, but I think down the road you'll see server manager start to do stuff because it could just make sense. That's my suggestion.
Okay. As a transition point off of that, someone actually asked about being able to run server manager client on Windows 7. The answer is no.
No.
We always make our RSAT tools available specifically to the version of the server that matches up to the client version as well. So if you want to manage 2012 R2 box, you need to have an 8.1 workstation running the RSAT tool specifically for it, but it's able to manage 2012 R2 and 2012 and 2008 and 2008 R2 systems. If you want to manage 2012 and you have an 8 box, then you have to have the RSAT tools for 2012 onto your 8 box. That's a workstation that's in there too. And someone was also asking about the PowerShell environment, and in case you're wondering, there is a jumpstart coming up on July the 18th, I do believe, if my date serves me correctly, with Jeffrey Snover and some MVPs, I do believe, doing a whole day just on PowerShell. I'm tuned in for that one. I'm actually working on the chat room for that
one. Yeah, I'm tuned in for that one, too.
It'll be very, very
anytime you can listen to Jeffrey, it's worth doing. He invented PowerShell 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah, that's great.
So.
Jumping right along to the last little bit of our section here, we've got access to information protection, and the idea basically, we're actually going to be joined by a special guest for this one. Corey's going to be taking a bit of a break, and we're going to be bringing on Adam Hall.
Translation, you're not smart enough, get Adam.
Oh, nice. He'll be joining us in the afternoon of day two, where we're going to be talking about all the enterprise functionality on the server side of access to information protection. They'll be talking about workplace join, I'll be talking about work folders, we'll also be talking about direct access, Active Directory on Azure, Active Directory Federation Services, Dynamic Access Control, all the really good stuff that's very, very cool, policy-based access, audit of corporate environments, that sort of stuff. That's going to be covered in a section with Adam.
So if you look at what is different in Active Directory for R2, there was a question that popped up in here.
Okay.
What's different in Active Directory in R2? And the answer is, in core Active Directory, nothing huge and significant, right? There's a lot of little incremental improvements, but there's no overarching big fundamental
GUI changes to the tools to be able to manage them and
right.
that sort of
and,
stuff.
And PowerShell updates and whatnot.
PowerShell updates.
The big set of improvements come around ADFS.
Yes.
Because as we start to move away from this notion of, you know, if you've ever taken a Microsoft certified professional course, you had this AGLP thing hammered into your head. Accounts in the global groups, local groups, local groups get permissions. That world is slowly disappearing as you no longer have control to the local device to grant permissions.
Yep.
And it's moving to a world that's based on claims, where permissions are based on attributes of the user in Active Directory, not necessarily groups that they belong to, right? And so ADFS is the mechanism of extending attribute-based access beyond the borders of your domain, so that you can take devices that are not in your domain, and they can, through ADFS, create claims, which are basically make statements. I'm Bob, I'm in sales, and I'm a level 3 sales rep, and I'm approved for confidential information.
Right.
That they can make those kinds of claims via authentication, and you can build an access control model based on claims.
And before everyone starts running away going, la, 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 don't want to hear this, it's able to be worked in together with your existing group-level access control entries at the same time, and you can do simulation to find out if this is going to work correctly, and then you can start to phase out and move stuff.
So you're right.
I had a lot of apprehension and fear with people. I'm going to lose my groups. I don't want to lose groups because I've been doing so much with them.
No, they're not going to go away unless you change.
Right. But you now have the ability to. Claims-based access is extremely important and also very granular. And you basically dynamically will grant more or less rights based on how you're accessing it, what you're accessing it from, and who you claim that you are.
And it's the basis for the new state of a machine.
Yep.
Because you've got, in the past, we have, I'm domain joined, I'm not domain joined. If I'm domain joined, I'm a full-fledged citizen. If I'm not domain joined, I'm a stranger.
Yep.
Now there's a middle ground, which is registered, which is I'm not domain joined and I'm not unknown. I'm known to Active Directory and I can do things with that. That's what Adam's going to get into. That's fun stuff.
Just before we get to that one there, we're going to be talking about VDI specifically because that's another whole section that's beyond doing access to information. And that's where we're going to be saying some of the new stuff. A lot of the new stuff with VDI isn't specifically with VDI itself. It's actually with all the now supported new changes under the hood that's now supported, like the storage tiering, the deduplication, that sort of stuff that can take place. That's where a lot of the new improvements have come from, down underneath where the VDI hood happens to be.
The way I look at VDI is almost like a cloud service.
Yeah.
Because it takes advantage of all the stuff that runs under the hood within Windows, with storage, with networking, with virtualization. And if you've not looked at VDI in 2012, you're going to get to see what it's all in there. A lot of it's very similar to R2. There's no big, massive overarching changes. They all came in 2012. So we'll go through all this and kind of show you, you know, again, how you step through user VHDs, pooled VHDs, private VHDs. All the management tools are different. So we'll get a chance to look at all of that. So, and remote effects.
Now, the funny thing is, there's a guy in the chat room called Cauley, C-A-U-L-L-E-Y, and he's a security guy, and he's concerned about groups, and now he's freaking out about dynamic access. So you've upset him, man. I'm just saying, it's not immediate. The support is there. You can phase it in and understand how this works and have a more design. It's actually ends up being a more secure environment.
Just because it exists doesn't mean you have to do it.
Right. You can still use the old way of doing stuff, and this is simply a new extra tool in your toolbox to be able to get stuff done.
Exactly. So, you know, just like high def TVs and cool cars, just because they exist don't mean you got to use them.
Yeah. You know what? I think we're at the very end, my friend.
Awesome.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Again, If you're asking questions inside the chat room, I am able to go off and take a look at them on the side here, and I will be grabbing into them some more when we get into the deep technical content. This was our overview section, just talking about all the different pieces that were there that are going to be covered throughout the next 2 days. And it also included some nice little demos as well.
Yep.
And covered all the major areas, fundamental changes to storage, to virtualization, to networking, and then also incremental changes inside those as well, based on 2012 and 2012 R2, and then bringing in all the stuff for access and information for AIP, bringing in the stuff for VDI, bringing in stuff for networking. So it's a big smattering of everything that's out there. Resource-wise, again, this little slide here at the side, MicrosoftVirtualAcademy.com has previously recorded content on Server 2012. A lot of the stuff we'll be talking about is applicable to 2012, but this is an incremental approach up on top of that. And if you want to go off and download the bits yourself, aka.ms/ws2012r2, and for System Center 2012r2, it is aka.ms/sc2012r2. So I say we need to have a little bit of a break to get set up for the next section, so I think we're going to be taking a 10-minute break to be able to switch between these guys. Don't drop off the line. Stay in the chat room. We'll be able to go off and to connect up with you there. And we'll get ready to get started. Our next section is going to be talking about...
Virtualization.
A whole section on vert. I can't wait. See you soon.